The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, How Big Tech is Fundamentally Changing the Triangle Startup Ecosystem. And the cover story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Playing the Game. As startups turn to big tech for support, questions emerge about what that means for local communities. Written by Lauren Onisorge. A bold vision. That's what it can take to make a startup a reality. A bold vision matched by a market that's buying what you're selling. For SignalPath, a startup born inside a Duke University laboratory, that vision, decreasing drug costs by making clinical trials more efficient, couldn't be contained within a 100-person company. Add in investors hungry for returns. They had funneled big bets in the firm, including an $18 million funder in 2019, and the pressure was mounting. CEO Brad Hirsch was ambitious. He wanted to change the world, and Google happened to be shopping. The Silicon Valley firm, though through its Verily subsidiary, announced in August that it would be acquiring SignalPath for an undisclosed sum, stating that by joining forces, the pair could decrease clinical trial costs. Alone in its laboratory, SignalPath could only grow so much, Hirsch says. But with Google, he says, we're going to double down and continue to expand our presence in Raleigh. It's a story that continues to play out across the country as big companies swoop in on exit deals. Often the entrepreneur takes their winnings and starts the next company, as was the case with Jesse Lipson, founder of ShareFile. A few years after Citrix purchased ShareFile, Lipson put some of his cash into a new startup, Levitate. When Bronto sold to what would eventually be Oracle, co-founder Joe Colopy started his own investment firm, funneling dollars into what he hoped would be the next big exit stories. But not every exit works out that way in terms of community payback. The challenge of selling. A new report out of UNC Chapel Hill shows that big tech exits can actually exacerbate economic inequality between regions. The report, which included data from 6 North Carolina startups sold to big tech companies, showed that the way exits happen gives a few regions, specifically Silicon Valley, the majority of the technology entrepreneurship success and its accompanying wealth. Of the more than 600 big tech acquisitions, those involving Amazon, Alphabet, Apple, Microsoft, Oracle, Adobe, and Facebook, the vast majority are in Silicon Valley, giving it a disproportionate weight when it comes to the national entrepreneurship story. The study found 48% of big tech acquisitions occurred in Silicon Valley, and that's just one of several home court advantages for Silicon Valley, as those startups were also found to be more successful at raising venture capital. And startups with early backing by venture capital firms significantly increased the likelihood of a big tech acquisition. Marianne Feldman at UNC's Keenan Institute says legislation aiming to rein in big tech could boost efforts around the country, including the Triangle. That's because the heavy startup concentration in a small number of regions has created what researchers describe as an economic vortex, one that threatens to pull in startups from other regions. The report, headed by Feldman in partnership with Simona Iamarino and Carolyn Iora Mashvili from the London School of Economics and Political Science, and Frederick Guy from the University of London, poses a few concerns about the way exits trend. In some cases, big tech folds in a startup, removing the footprint from the community where it was incubated. In other cases, it dissolves the brand innovation completely. For example, BlueStripe disappeared into Microsoft's brand after the Morrisville company was acquired in 2015. And in up to 7.4% of acquisitions, a firm is purchased to kill a competing project entirely. All in all, the state of North Carolina has been lucky. The bulk of its big tech acquisitions has meant more investment. Skia, for example, a Chapel Hill graphics firm that started above a t-shirt shop on Franklin Street, sold to Google in 2005. Founder Mike Reed stayed at the company and pushed for expansion. In addition to growing into a downtown building with the Google logo, Google is planning a 1,000-job hub in Durham. But they haven't all worked out that way, and that's not always a negative. Amazon, for example, acquired Charlotte-based Yap in 2011, utilizing the technology in what would become Alexa, while creating a new division but erasing the Yap name. Yap founder Igor Jablokov is currently building a new artificial intelligence company, Prion, in Raleigh. He says the Amazon deal was about realizing the vision, something the firm just couldn't do on its own. Creating something like what would be the Echo device would take hundreds of billions of dollars, a lot more capital than we could get from venture capital, he says. In exiting, Jablokov can now point to Alexa and realize he had a hand in what's become a household name. With Yap, it was kismet. It was creating something, and Amazon wanted it. Reduced innovation. But when analyzing startups across the country, Feldman says that's not always the case. The report shows researchers were concerned that startups seeking to be acquired were biased toward inventions that could improve an existing technology of a big tech firm in order to make them a more attractive target. This reduces innovation and competition, the report reads. And even Jablokov admits exits aren't for everyone and that headlines can create unrealistic expectations. They can also stifle innovation, the research out of UNC says. When an acquisition happens, it can create a winner-take-all dynamic where competing projects can struggle to win capital because of the perception that the acquired startup won the race to be acquired. For the Triangle, Feldman says there's a concern that exits could take innovators out of the Triangle altogether. Homegrown tech firms such as Pendo and SAS help build the region's prowess as a tech cluster, attracting additional economic development. But the cluster model really only works when the companies stay here, Feldman says. If a promising startup leaves to pursue a more promising venture capital picture elsewhere, it's not adding to the Triangle's ecosystem. In some cases, the opposite has been true in the COVID area. George Kirkland, for example, moved from San Francisco to Durham when work from home allowed his family to take advantage of the cheaper living costs here. Following the sale of his California startup, RaiseMe, to Uber, he founded a new technology firm in Bull City, HomeCloud. Kirkland knows he's in the minority, saying he has heard firsthand the perception among California innovators that you just can't build unicorns in the Triangle. A lot of people feel like they have to leave North Carolina to have a venture-backed startup, but that's not the case, he says. The only way to combat that perception is by showcasing success here, Kirkman says, and it might also require blockbuster exits. Seeking home runs. James Avery, CEO of Durham tech firm Kevel, says that while the region has had doubles and triples, we don't have home runs or grand slams. We just don't have those big ecosystem-changing exits, he says. Avery says to make a big tech deal really pay off, you need a local advocate, too. He points to ShareFiles acquisition by Citrix. When ShareFiles Lipson was running the local operation, Citrix was like a force in the area, he says. When Lipson left to start Levitate, Citrix was a quieter presence. For years, insiders have said it's just a matter of time before an even bigger exit, and many predict the next one will happen in downtown Raleigh, pointing to Pendo as having the ecosystem building effect, Avery mentions. The firm recently closed on $150 million, bringing its valuation to $2.6 billion. And CEO Todd Olson admits an exit, particularly an initial public offering, is a possibility. Our job is to prepare the company to possibly be a public company, Olson says. Whether or not we go public becomes a matter of how the markets are, what the general business climate is. Longtime analytics giant SAS, too, is the topic of these type of discussions, as CEO Jim Goodnight has said the firm is planning an IPO by 2024. And the potential risks and rewards are high in both instances. An exit could create an influx of wealth at insiders, particularly at Pendo, where equity is part of the compensation package, could leverage for future startups and investments. But the risks are high, as Goodnight was reminded of when reports were released earlier this year that the firm was in exit talks with Broadcom. Those talks reportedly fizzled amid poor public perception of the deal, leading to Goodnight's announcement about a possible IPO. Some have suspected the IPO plans are perhaps a mating call for another big tech acquirer, perhaps in longtime partner Microsoft. Feldman says whatever happens will have a major impact on the region. That could be a massive That could be massive for the area, she says, noting the impact gets even bigger if SAS opens up equity to its employees. The fact that the region is at a point where multiple firms are in the exit conversation signals the maturing of the ecosystem, Feldman says. But as her report notes, change can happen quickly. Right now, we have a really vibrant ecosystem, she says, pointing to investors such as Hatteras Capital and Bull City Venture Partners as providing options outside of Silicon Valley. But more funding is critical in the ecosystem's resilience. We're spending so much money on incentives to attract large firms like Apple, and really not enough for startups, Feldman says. What's missing here is this ability for firms to scale. And now we turn to the continuing series, 52 Shades of Success. About this project, the 52-week project showcases accomplishments, challenges, and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by people of color, women, immigrants, veterans, representatives from the LGBTQ plus community, and a few other groups forwarding the mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. The project also will delve into important trends and issues relating to DEI. The headline, Working to Fill a Gap. Ryan Oxendine saw a pocket of need in rural North Carolina and built a law practice to help the most vulnerable all across the state. Story by Connie Gentry. The distance from Robbins to Raleigh is roughly 75 miles, but the distance measured in socioeconomics is worlds apart. Robbins is a small town in northern Moore County with just over 1,600 residents, a 41% poverty rate, and a median household income of $40,200, according to Data USA. It's also the town where Ryan Oxendine of Lumbee Indian Heritage grew up. Today, Oxendine's successful law firm is based in North Raleigh, where the Wake County population exceeds 1.1 million. The poverty rate of 8% is negligible by comparison, and the median household income, $80,591, is more than double that of his hometown. His journey to opening Oxendine Barns in 2012 traveled a circuitous path after completing undergraduate studies at UNC Chapel Hill, followed by NC Central University School of Law. Oxendine returned to Moore County, where he worked at Van Camp, Meacham, and Newman PLLC in Pinehurst from 2001 to 2008. Pinehurst is the rich side of the county where I grew up was in the sticks, Oxendine says. In Pinehurst, I was doing a lot of development work and commercial work, but when the economy and real estate took a dip in 2008, I decided I needed to get to a big city, so I moved to Raleigh. From 2008 to 2011, he worked at Underwood & Roberts, PLLC, a firm that provides legal services for high-net-worth families and owners of closely held businesses. What he quickly realized was that he could better achieve the kind of law practice he wanted by going out on his own. It was a risky start as he transitioned to a focus on civil litigation, and while the need for attorneys to represent plaintiffs in lawsuits was plentiful, the compensation was often on a contingency basis. It's a funny story, Oxendine quips, describing how he negotiated a deal for leasing office space for 5 months, rent-free. I kept wondering, will I be able to make my first rent payment on that 6 month? Well, I got two large cases, one out of Robson County and another from where I grew up back in Robbins. Both were contingency cases. One was $1.5 million and the other was $2 million. Those settled before the six-month rent came due, and I got a one-third contingency fee, so I was able to make that first rent payment. In 2014, Jim Barnes, a fraternity brother from Oxendine's UNC days, joined the practice. The two attorneys learned early on in their careers that there was a need that stemmed from underserved, underrepresented communities, and their practice worked to address that void. Ryan's family is from Robson County, and a large percentage of clients we represent are from there. There is a need from that pocket of the state and that community, Barnes says. With a median household income just shy of $35,000 and a poverty rate of 31.5%, Robson County, like the town of Robbins, is stretched thin. The demographics are predominantly people of color, roughly 42% American Indian, 24% Black, 9% Latinx, and 25% white. My dad is from Pembroke in Robson County, and I have my Lumbee card, Oxendine says. Our law practice only has one billboard, and it's in Robson County with my photo in front of my grandmother's house. She sees it every day when she comes out on her front porch, and that billboard is how I got that big case that allowed me to pay my rent at 6 months. While a large number of clients come from Robeson County, Oxendine Barnes works throughout the state from Greenville to Wilmington and across the Triangle, as well as in South Carolina and other states. 5 years ago, the firm handled a case in Minneapolis, a business dispute around a non-compete agreement, and the attorneys recalled that the people in Minnesota just knew they were dealing with dumb Southerners, a misperception the lawyers milked to an advantageous outcome for their client. The last 18 months have brought numerous changes to the practice, including more cases involving excessive force, medical malpractice, and civil rights. In one of the more prominent excessive force cases involving a white man and law enforcement, Oxendine says, "We demanded $5 million. They only offered $25,000 in mediation. But when it settled, they paid $3.3 million more than we demanded, $8.3 million total. The murder of George Floyd brought a lot of cases to our attention, so we've taken, and some we haven't," Barnes adds. "Currently, we're handling a case against the Raleigh Police Department that involves the shooting of a black man. And COVID has made so many changes across every bit of our practice." For starters, the firm's revenue plunged 65% in 2020 after the courts were closed due to the pandemic. Mediation via Zoom proved less than productive. 2019 was really strong, the best year since the business opened. But 2020 was completely different, Oxendine says. Revenue went down because the courts closed and we couldn't say during a mediation, "We'll see you in court." The defense knew we weren't going to court. It's sort of that way now. We have several minor settlement hearings, and I think the defense is slow playing it because with this Delta variant, the courts may shut down again. As tight as cash flow was in 2020, Oxendine Barnes remained busy and did not have any layoffs. They received a PPP loan in April 2020 for $18,600 that was subsequently forgiven in April 2021. While settlements and income were interrupted by COVID, demand for their services grew, with many lawsuits resulting from disputes surrounding increased workforce demands and ever-changing policies. The governor's executive order number 130, issued on April 8, 2020, essentially precludes medical malpractice cases in instances related to COVID. Oxendine and Barnes say this is at the forefront of their minds every day as they get requests to handle a range of medical cases. In one of our current cases, our client had an allergic reaction when she received the COVID vaccine. An EpiPen dose was administered in her muscle while she was at the vaccine facility, but en route to the hospital, the attending EMS provider, who was a student in training, gave her another dose of epinephrine, but instead of administering it in her muscle as required, it was mistakenly given through our client's IV, which sent her into cardiac arrest, Oxendine explains. The defense attorney claims the case falls under Executive Order 130 and will be dismissed. Oxendine says this illustrates how the COVID executive order is too broad and too vague. The firm anticipates 2020 will be similar to 2019, in part because of the backlog of cases being resolved as well as the volume of cases underway. And in a section called A Closer Look, Oxendine Barnes & Associates, PLLC, Ryan Oxendine, founder and managing partner, Jim Barnes, managing partner, location 6500 Creedmoor Road, Suite 100, Raleigh. Founded 2012, employees 6, PPP loan $18,600, by the numbers 65% drop in revenue from 2019 to 2020. Expected revenue rebound 2022. And we also have one news item in the 52 Shades of Success section, how Durham LGBTQ plus festival adapted to COVID restrictions. The Out South Queer Film Festival, hosted by the Carolina Theater in Durham, ran from August 13 through 19, and as in 2020, this year's event was virtual, where ticket purchasers could live stream films and access the website 24/7 during the week. While streaming allows us to join together as a virtual community, unfortunately, it doesn't have quite the same cachet as an in-person affair, says Chuck Wheeler, manager of Out South. The festival included 102 films and 9 online Q&A sessions with filmmakers and artists. The Q&As were available to view at no cost. Fans of the festival will tell you that the live event is one of the highlights of LGBTQ plus life in the Triangle, and the Carolina Theater, which is the producer and curator of Out South, becomes a destination for the queer community to gather and celebrate, Wheeler says. As a virtual event, Out South was available online to 10 states and Washington, D.C. While attendance, that is, ticket sales, did not match the numbers of a live event, online ticket purchases were essentially unchanged from 2020 to 2021, and corporate sponsorship levels rivaled pre-2020 support. The festival lineup was a diverse mix of the best in queer cinema that we could offer to our community, Wheeler says. Out South has always strived to include something for everyone in its selections, though we realized in 2018 that our name, the North Carolina Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, NCGLFF, failed to reflect just how inclusive we already were. In 2019, the name of the festival was changed to Out South Queer Film Festival, a recognition that the event is dedicated to screening all aspects of queer life. In 2022, the festival will celebrate its 27th anniversary, and as Wheeler says, the hopeful return to celebrating Out South at the Carolina Theater in downtown Durham. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Post office to leave North Hills. The North Hills area of Raleigh is adding amenities like mad, but that burgeoning part of town may soon be without something that was once a staple, a post office. The location of the U.S. Postal Service at 350 East Six Forks Road will close as USPS continues to streamline operations. The Postal Service, in a news release, said the office will move to a yet-to-be-determined location as close as reasonably possible to the former site. Of course, as close as reasonably possible could mean anything, even going gasp outside the Beltline. It's an interesting move on a pair of fronts. This is the post office location that previously had been at North Hills for decades, but when Kane Realty renovated the Lassiter side of North Hills, the longtime location of the U.S. Postal Service moved down Six Forks Road. The location is in a building that is largely an empty shell after the Kroger grocery store closed in August 2018. Popular event is back in Raleigh. Brewgaloo, a festival that celebrates more than 100 craft breweries from across North Carolina, returns to downtown Raleigh September 17 and 18. The festival, which drew thousands of thirsty fans before the pandemic, includes a block party the first night with 3-ounce samples of a wide variety of beers. Then September 18, the party expands from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. The main event, put on by Shop Local Raleigh, was canceled in 2020 in favor of a smaller event. Tourism dollars start to perk up. The pandemic hasn't gone away just yet, but the hard-hit tourism industry is starting to see some encouraging trends. Wake County tourism tax collections for July were $2.2 million, up 106% from July 2020. And for the year, collections are at $11.4 million, up 29% from the same time last year. Meanwhile, occupancy rates at Wake County hotels were at 59.1% for the week of August 29 through September 4, up 42% from the same time last year. Greenville lays groundwork. Two economic development consultants who specialize in site selection and engineering visited Greenville earlier this month as the area looks to attract more businesses. Greenville ENC Alliance hosted Eric Miller, president of EKM Strategies, and Deepal Ilatambi, president of Alliance Consulting Engineers Incorporated, for a 3-day visit where they toured the city and the surrounding region, evaluating possible sites for businesses looking to expand in eastern North Carolina. We decided that as a new organization, we're just a little over a year old, that we needed to have a time where we focused on our assets and bring in site solution consultants that could help advance our agenda with lead generation, says Yukonda Dunn, Vice President of Business Development for Greenville ENC Alliance. Another builder joins Wendell Falls. The booming Wendell Falls development has landed its latest builder. Brookfield Property says home builder McNeil Burbank, formerly known as Saucy Burbank, plans a cottage collection of single-family homes. We're thrilled to be breaking ground in the Wendell Falls community in 2021, since our build story has strong ties with the developer dating back to the beginning of the Briar Chapel community, says Luke Bothapedi, sales consultant at McNeil Burbank. The company has long been a part of Newland's Briar Chapel development in Chapel Hill. The new homes will feature 1,500 to 2,000 square foot layouts and prices starting in the upper 300,000s. Brookfield Properties acquired Newland, the developer behind Wendell Falls and Briar Chapel, earlier this year. And finally, new Triangle leader takes reins. After a long career, the Triangle region president for Truist is retiring, and a successor has taken the reins. Gray Reed is retiring after a 38-year career that included more than two decades with BB&T and then Truist following the merger of SunTrust Banks and BB&T in 2019. His replacement is Chris Bell, who had been middle market banking leader for the Triangle region. Bell started in his new role on September 7. Reed's last day will be September 30. Chris is an experienced banker with a strong track record of supporting our clients, growing our business, and delivering on our purpose of inspiring and building better lives and communities, says David Weaver, Truist's Chief Commercial Community Banking Officer. Charlotte-based Truist holds the second-largest deposit share in both the Raleigh and Durham-Chapel Hill markets. Overall, its Triangle deposits are approaching $12 billion. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to On Aviation and Tech, written by Lauren Onasorge. Flights scaled back. As Delta variant rages, airlines cut flights at RDU. Many airlines are seeing softer bookings in the months ahead as the Delta variant spreads. The virus is one factor leading airlines to scale back the number of flights scheduled for the latter portion of the year, according to a review of flight data by the Triangle Business Journals. The data from Cirium, a provider of aviation and travel data analytics, shows total scheduled domestic flight operations for the fourth quarter fell nearly 6.4% between August 3rd and August 30th. It's a marked difference from earlier in the year when many airlines were boosting capacity and relaunching routes as vaccination rates climbed and COVID-19 cases were on the decline. At Raleigh-Durham International Airport, airlines have slashed schedules by more than 14% for the fourth quarter. On August 3, they anticipated operating nearly 16,700 flights between October and December. But as of August 20th, that number had been slashed to less than 14,300, according to Cirium. The shift may come down to continued softness in business travel, typically a major driver at RDU. Pre-pandemic, business travel accounted for about half of RDU's traffic. Now, it's about 30%, according to an RDU spokeswoman. Through July, nearly 2.2 million passengers had boarded planes at RDU, a 39% uptick from a year ago, but it's still not on track with pre-pandemic numbers, as nearly 3.9 million passengers had boarded RDU planes during the same time period in 2019. But RDU is not alone. All 50 of the nation's largest airports saw a drop in scheduled fourth quarter flights between August 3rd and August 30th, with hubs in Chicago down 10%, Atlanta down 10%, and Houston down 9%, posting the biggest drops among the 10 largest airports. The data is based on flights originating at the airports. The changes aren't limited to one airline. Among the list of the 10 airports with the steepest declines were hubs for American Airlines, Philadelphia, Delta Airlines, Atlanta, Detroit, and Minneapolis, and United Airlines, Houston, Chicago, and San Francisco. And Ty West also contributed to that article. Court rejects appeal for Steven Peters, convicted in $15 million Ponzi scheme. Almost 2 years to the day after being handed a 40-year sentence on federal fraud, money laundering, and obstruction of justice charges, former Raleigh financier Steven Peters saw his appeal effort rejected. Peters, convicted of orchestrating a $15 million Ponzi scheme through his downtown Raleigh finance firm, VisionQuest, is currently serving time at a federal prison in Virginia, with a release date set for 2053. His appeals attorney, William Turpining, didn't return a request to comment on the appeal decision, which was handed down on September 9. Peters had sought a complete acquittal via appeal, and his attorney had put forward several arguments, all of which were shot down by the U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. "We affirm the district court's judgment," the court wrote. "We dispense with oral argument because the facts and legal contentions are adequately presented in the materials before this court, and argument would not aid the decisional process." According to court records and trial testimony, Peters defrauded 94 victims, costing them more than $15 million. Serial entrepreneur raises millions for startup. A serial entrepreneur's augmented reality startup is looking to raise millions, Raleigh-based Transmira, founded by Robert Rice, has closed on more than $692,000, according to a recent securities disclosure. The filing shows the round is targeted at $2.8 million. The funds will be used primarily for development of the technology, a filing states. Transmira, according to its website, is developing technology aimed at making it easy for brands, businesses, and content creators to monetize metaverse technologies ranging from augmented reality to virtual reality. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from Vlad Rozanovich, Lenovo's new North American president, on how both corporate and household clients are looking to technology to provide flexibility at home and the office. What we saw was a complete acceleration to technology. It's the center of how they work, they play, they connect. And finally, a big number, $142,000. That's the average wage for jobs at remdesivir maker Gilead Sciences that will be coming to Raleigh, North Carolina, Department of Commerce records show. Gilead also considered Durham and Atlanta for those 275 jobs. And now we turn to the On Greater Triangle Growth page, written by Evan Hoopfer. Targeting the small towns. Food halls are gaining steam across the country, and a local group wants to expand the concept to smaller towns in the Triangle. Raleigh-based Crafton plans to bring two locations to the Triangle, with a Knightdale spot eyeing an opening around Halloween or November, and another locale in Clayton planning to open next spring. We look specifically to grow our business in smaller towns, tertiary markets that tend to not have great food options, for lack of a better way of saying it, says hospitality veteran Max Trujillo, one of Crafton's co-founders, along with entrepreneur Kip Downer. Crafton is putting a spin on the traditional food hall model. Instead of patrons visiting the counter of a specific concept, they sit down at a table and order off a menu like a traditional restaurant. That means a family can order tacos, burgers, and arepas from different concepts, but all under one check. On the back end of it, all of their products are coded individually, Trujillo says. Whatever is ordered by the guest goes separately into the vendor's bank account. Tenants for the Knightdale location include Poblanos Tacos, Fiori Trattoria, The Corner Venezuelan, and Finca Burger. Trujillo says Crafton is close to filling up the space in Clayton, but declined to name specific tenants until full leases are signed. Chatham Park Medical Facility sells for over $11 million. The Chatham Park Medical Office building that's home to UNC Health traded hands for $11.37 million recently. Montecito Medical, based in Nashville, Tennessee, bought the property at 75 Freedom Parkway in Pittsburgh, according to a deed dated September 2nd. The seller is listed as Privado, an LLC which lists Preston Development founders Tim Smith and Julian Bubba Rawl among its company officials. Preston Development is the company behind Chatham Park. Montecito is one of the largest privately held acquirers of medical real estate in the country and targets medical office properties valued between $4 to $150 million, according to its website. UNC Health provides services in several different fields at the facility, including family medicine, rheumatology, therapeutic infusion, cardiology, and more. Smithfield okays over 650 new homes. The Smithfield Town Council approved a rezoning request September 7 for 200 acres that paves the way for a major housing development. Plans for Floyd Landing call for 89 detached single-family homes, 220 townhomes, and 360 apartment units for a total of 669 new residences for the community. Cary-based Carolina Land Group is the developer, according to planning documents submitted to the town, and Raleigh-based CE Group is aiding in preparing the land. The spot lies just north of Smithfield corporate limits and south of U.S. Highway 70. Business near the site of a future Amazon facility. The development team said in a previous application it would petition the division for annexation into Smithfield. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from East Carolina University College of Business Dean Paul Schwager on how a $5 million gift from alumnus Tom Arthur will help it to expand its graduate programs and better target the military. We've always been good in military, but I think this gives us a chance to be great in military. And finally, a big number, plus 2.8%. How many more homes for sale there were in Johnston County in July compared to June, according to Zillow. This indicates the housing market could be cooling as more product comes available for purchase. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Caleb Harshberger. Rezoning planned. Kane preps for next wave of development at North Hills. The next wave of development at North Hills is officially in the works as Kane Realty Corporation plans to petition the city of Raleigh to rezone several portions of the district for more urban development. The request will seek the rezoning of four sites, two along Six Forks Road, requesting mixed use up to 40 stories, one along Lassiter Mill Road, abutting I-440, requesting 30 stories, and one behind the existing Total Wine store seeking 12 stories. This rezoning is for the next iteration of North Hills, says Bonner Gaylord, Kane Realty's chief operating officer. There are fundamentally two ways the city can grow. Since we're not making any more land, we can grow up or we can grow out into more suburban sprawl. We believe we should grow up in the urban nodes. The company is expected to file the request this month. Gaylord says the changes are in line with the company's vision of bringing more dense urban growth to the market. It's really a cleanup of these parcels. They haven't been through a rezoning in 20 years or so, he says. Meanwhile, the area around the sites has changed dramatically. Kane has yet to finalize any plans for the sites, but all are expected to feature ground floor retail with either office, residential, or a mix of the two above, as is becoming the norm in North Hills. No timelines have been finalized for the start of development either. Gaylord says there's heavy demand for all uses in North Hills, so they have some flexibility. To the extent that all the buildings are full, we're lacking in everything, he says. The zoning comes as big developments continue to reshape North Hills. Construction continues on the Walter condo tower, and work is well underway at the former site of JCPenney. Plans include a 10-story office tower near the Renaissance Hotel, an 80,000-square-foot creative office space where the JCPenney was located, 270 residential units near Lassiter Mill Road, and another future tower. Kane Realty is also moving ahead on plans for the massive North Hills Innovation District, which the company announced earlier this year. Raleigh firm plots 70,000-square-foot building in Garner. A Raleigh-based real estate firm is launching its debut life sciences development in the Triangle with plans for a flex space and life sciences project in Garner. Greenhawk Corporation, which also has offices in New York City, has announced plans for a 73,000-square-foot Flex Life Sciences building at 350 Hine Drive, east of Interstate 40 and south of Highway 70 Business. We have been part of Garner for many years and value the relationship we have with the town. It's been exciting to see Garner change and evolve, says Jeremy Medlin, Executive Vice President of Real Estate at Greenhawk. The site is in the whole of a donut-shaped area of industrial and office properties in the growing town. Morrisville Flex Complex sold for $21 million. A Flex Complex in Morrisville has changed hands in a $21 million deal that joins a boom in recent real estate deals and development along Airport Boulevard. On September 10, an affiliate of New York-based Nuveen Real Estate paid $21.3 million for 1100 Perimeter Park Drive, featuring a large single-story flex complex. Built in 1989, the property at 1100 Perimeter Park Drive features 84,164 square feet of flex space and is situated on 9.4 acres. The JLL Capital Markets team of John Mickles, Daniel Flynn, Chris Lingerfelt, Ryan Clutter, and Woody Flythe represented the seller in the deal. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from Robert Cardos, the Beechwood Organization regional president for the Carolinas. On closing on 130 acres along Highway 501, slated for a mixed-use community called South Creek by Beechwood in Chapel Hill. Our goal is to provide the greater Chapel Hill community with a development that speaks to its residential and commercial real estate needs in a way that encompasses our shared values, sustainability, stewardship, environmentalism, inclusiveness, and responsible growth. And finally, the big number, $71 million. That's how much the Priest Company paid for the 203-unit Trilogy Cameron Village Apartments in a deal that closed September 9. That's a hefty $349,753 per unit for the property on 3.7 acres at 305 Oberlin Road. And now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page, written by Erica Wells. The first headline, Nike Live Concept Coming to Cary. Building permit application for the Nike space at Fenton filed. One of Nike's retail concepts could be added to a mixed-use destination underway in Cary. A building permit application to make way for Nike Live at Fenton was filed with the town on September 3rd, according to public records. The first phase of Fenton, the 69-acre mixed-use district along Interstate 40 in Carytown Boulevard, is set to open in April. The total construction cost for the Nike project, which is in its early stages, is $1.06 million, according to the application. Construction plans for the 6,055-square-foot space near Trinity Road are currently under review with the town. Hines, one of Fenton's developers, and Nike both declined to comment on Nike's plans. The brick-and-mortar location will offer in-person shopping while emphasizing the digital experience with the use of the Nike app. The Nike Live pilot store opened on Melrose Avenue in Los Angeles in 2018 to target members of an earlier version of Nike Run Club, a performance tracking app for runners. The Nike Live concept is open to the public and caters to a local community's tastes and activities, and also allows members access to additional perks. Similar to other Nike Live locations, plans include making the Fenton store an LEED certified location, according to the permit application. In 2020, Nike said it planned to open 150 to 200 small format Nike Live locations in North America, the Middle East, and Africa, according to Chain Store Age. In May, Triangle Business Journal reported the company was looking at moving into office space at the iconic Parkline building in Chapel Hill. Smoky Hollow adds tenants with yoga studio, deli, and smokehouse. In the coming months, Smoky Hollow, the new mixed-use district in downtown Raleigh, will welcome Dose Yoga Plus Smoothies, J Lights, Madre, and Midwood Smokehouse. Dose Yoga and Smoothies owner Emily Wallace will bring the hot yoga studio and natural smoothie bar concept to Raleigh. Wallace previously co-owned Midwood Yoga and 110 Yoga in the city, but now hopes Dose will be more of a one-stop shop, she says. Jared Burton will expand his bodega-style deli, J Lights, to Smoky Hollow after finding success at the first location in Durham's Golden Belt campus. Both locations offer light meal options, but the new space will have a full coffee program. Tyler Helixson, who is behind Happy and Hale in Raleigh and Durham, is investing in a new small plates concept with wine and cocktails called Madre, Spanish for mother, with business partner Brad Schaff. Brunch will be available on weekends. The award-winning Midwood Smokehouse will open its first location in Raleigh. Restaurateur Frank Scabelli launched the restaurant in Charlotte in 2011 and now has additional locations in the Queen City and another in Columbia, South Carolina. Pitmaster and Lexington native Matthew Berry will lead the Smoky Hollow location. Investor Group buys Cary Shopping Center. A Food Lion-anchored shopping center in Cary has changed ownership in a $10.2 million sale. Parkway Point at 2426 Southwest Cary Parkway was purchased by Ohio-based SM Venture Limited Partnership from SCP Parkway Point LLC on September 1, according to Wake County deed records. Both the buyer and seller have been affiliates of Illinois-based investor group Shiner Capital Partners, which includes real estate firm The Shiner Group. The shopping center is situated between Old Apex and Laura Duncan Roads and includes a Subway, Tangerine Cafe, H&R Block, and a former Rite Aid pharmacy. The shopping center totals over 82,000 square feet and sits on 10.59 acres of land. And in a section called She Said It, a quote from Paula DiPano, a Filipino-American sommelier, on opening Rocks and Acid in Chapel Hill. With everything that has happened in the hospitality industry in the last few months, this is a dream for me to open my own store. And as a female and a person of color, especially since it's local, and there's a lot of curiosity around it. And finally, a big number, $189 million. That's the total amount in future retail sales for downtown Raleigh if 2021's development pipeline is fully completed, according to Downtown Raleigh Alliance's most recent State of Downtown Raleigh report. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of Triangle Business Journals. The headline, Onus on Employers, Government, and Workers. One can take sides as much as they want, but one thing became clear after late March 2020. The coronavirus pandemic was going to create havoc on the national economy, and it did. The U.S. economy went through the worst contraction in 100 years, and millions of people were left without jobs, and thousands of businesses were either closed down temporarily or shuttered permanently. And yet, during this traumatic economic disruption, the country's poverty rate declined. How, you ask? Government, that's how. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, 9.1% of Americans were poor last year, down from 11.8% in 2019. The primary reason of this drop was because the government played its intended role in helping the millions that were in dire need of help. Assistance in unemployment benefits, food aid, stimulus payments, business grants, and deferred tax payments all contributed to Americans having more money in their pockets in 2020. The poverty rate, in return, went down. The government offered a temporary solution to our economic problem, but in implementing the short-term plan, we now may have created a long-term problem. How to wean off the millions who are now used to government aid. In order to have an organic supply and demand flow of labor, everyone from businesses to government to workers needs to play a role in fixing this growing problem. For millions of businesses, understandably, 2020 and 2021 may have been their worst years. But whether the pandemic affected the top line or the bottom line, nearly everyone got a boost from the government in the form of the U.S. Paycheck Protection Program or the Small Business Administration's Economic Injury and Disaster Loan Program. Nearly $1 trillion in taxpayer money went to support businesses. In return, businesses kept workers employed and paid their bills. So to every business that is now crying about government's unemployment benefits keeping workers from coming back to work, here's something in simple terms that they may need to understand. Pay them competitive wages and benefits. You got your money from the government. I can't even tell you how many business owners I've met in the past year who should not have gotten 1 cent of government money, but they did because they could. It was all legal and it was there for the taking. Stop this blame game and work with folks by offering them a little more than they would expect. In the end, you will pass most of that added cost on to the consumer anyway. For most of the workers out there, this is your market. You will have choices, so choose your employer wisely. It's not going to be like this forever. When the economy slows down, the supply-demand curve will reverse course, and then getting a job is going to be more difficult. And if you are on the sidelines, content with the unemployment benefits and defrauding the government by going to interviews and not showing up for work when given a job, that gravy train will end as well. And that brings me to my third point. State and federal government must create a system to double-check unemployment claims, especially the ones that verify multiple interviews but no jobs. Workers and employers should be required to fill out similar forms after the interview and after the hiring decision has been made. If it's too hard to track, perhaps employers and potential workers should go to a government office to do interviews after being checked in by a government employee. Sounds complex? It is not. If we want, we can find a solution, and we need everyone's help. This is not a one-dimensional issue. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to some general news stories. Developers' plan for a huge RTP project just got much bigger. This story is written by Caleb Harshberger. A Charlotte-based developer has unveiled plans for its portion of a huge development in Research Triangle Park, revealing a major expansion to the initial plans announced late last year. On September 14, White Point unveiled the new plans, which show a 125,000-square-foot mixed-use complex dubbed the Horseshoe at Hub RTP. We are honored to be a part of the innovative Hub RTP team and to be responsible for creating a destination for those within the RTP as well as from across the triangle, says Eric Johnson, co-founder of White Point. We intend to deliver a unique mixed-use development as we have successfully done in some of the leading live-work-play neighborhoods of the Carolinas. The name references the shape of the building, which the company said represents RTP's role as a brain magnet. In December, the company said it planned just 50,000 square feet of development, evenly split between retail and office, though company officials said it could expand. Today, the plan features 25,000 square feet of experiential retail space, plus about 100,000 square feet of creative office space. What we're trying to accomplish at this part of the hub is creating the placemaking area, Johnson says. On the upper levels, we want to make sure we're adding office that is complementary to the retail. The estimated cost of the project is $50 million. White Point will ultimately own the land that makes up its portion of the project. The complex will be built around a large outdoor plaza. Site work at Hub RTP, located between Highway 54 and Interstate 40 near Davis Drive, is slated to finish in mid-2022, and White Point plans to complete the complex in Q3 2023. CBRE is handling the food, beverage, and retail leasing at the development. JLL is handling office leasing. Altogether, Hub RTP will include around 2 million square feet of mixed-use space, including office, lab, retail, entertainment, residential, and hospitality. The announcement comes just weeks after Longfellow announced its entrance into the Hub RTP project, with plans to develop 220,000 square feet of office and life sciences space at Hub RTP. The building will feature state-of-the-art lab space and Class A office space, according to the company. And in news from around the state, NCA&T grads look to expedite life insurance process with startup. This is written by Lillian Johnson. There are 102 million uninsured and underinsured Americans who know they need or need more life insurance, according to the Life Insurance Marketing and Research Association. So why not just buy? One big reason is the process of applying for and buying life insurance can be long and complicated, taking weeks and making customers jump through hoops. Harmony, a startup founded by North Carolina A&T State University graduates Anthony Lewis and Jordan Maness, aims to remediate this issue. Harmony, spelled H-A-R-M-O-N-E-E, will provide a digital-focused buying platform that will reduce the application process from weeks to just minutes. Through Harmony's website and back-end integrations with healthcare systems, customers can share their health data, getting rid of the need for a new physical or blood work, which is often what elongates the process. Customers will also complete a questionnaire about their lifestyle, and Harmony will provide approval and price quotes. Harmony plans to partner with established life insurance agencies while retaining its own in-house marketing and sales. Focusing on younger and minority demographics, Harmony also wants to educate people on life insurance, why it's needed, and the different types of policies. COVID has brought to the forefront, unfortunately, that families are having to deal with the unexpected, untimely passing of people of all ages, Lewis says. I think people are becoming more aware that we want to leave behind legacies and good thoughts and not, in the moment when tragedy hits, have to scramble and figure out money. That should be the last thing that we have to be concerned about when one of the most tragic things that can happen in your life happens. As of September 12th, Harmony has raised $19,852, surpassing the $10,000 minimum to receive the funding. They can raise a maximum of $107,000 due to regulations based on the startup phase they are in. And now we turn to the executive voice to read about Catherine Crosby. The headline, taking the lead in Apex. After a long career in Ohio, Catherine Crosby is on a new path with the town of Apex. Written by Caleb Harshberger. Before her recent move to North Carolina, newly minted Apex town manager Catherine Crosby spent the last two decades working in government administration in the struggling Ohio towns of Dayton and Toledo. Now she manages a town unlike any she'd lived in before, and she's the first black woman to take on the role in Apex. Originally from Cleveland, Crosby studied accounting at Wilberforce University in Ohio. Upon graduating, she landed an internal auditing job and soon after began pursuing a master's in public administration while getting involved in local government. She started volunteering at the Urban League in Dayton and landed a job as an assistant director with the city of Dayton in 2005. Crosby stayed with the city for 13 years, moving up to executive director in 2012. In her time in Dayton, Crosby says she managed a number of operations in the city, from gun violence reduction programs and small business development to work encouraging equitable community development. She also continued picking up education and skills, particularly in organizational management and in working with groups and individuals that find themselves at odds over an issue. By 2018, Crosby was ready for her next challenge and took a job as the chief of staff in Toledo. "My work in Dayton really helped in Toledo because of the work in intergroup tension," Crosby says. "A lot of the work I had to do was to listen to community needs and respond. While I oversaw day-to-day operations, I had to navigate the community leaders and government officials. And things in Toledo weren't necessarily easier. The city saw frequent turnover in political leadership, which often translated to shakeups throughout city departments. As a strong mayor form of government, every time the mayor changes, that was a change in organization," Crosby says. "The town also struggled with an infrastructure system in desperate need of investment and neighborhoods seeking more access to resources." Crosby says a lot of her work was putting policies into place to address these issues the best she could and work with communities to best plan for the future. "A lot of the work I needed to do there was changing policies and procedures, helping to draft community economic development strategy," she says. 2 years into that job, the pandemic hit, followed by protests in the summer. "We had to do a lot of listening. We looked at what was happening nationally and locally," Crosby says. "In terms of the pandemic, we did well. We did have a decline in revenue. In Ohio, income tax is the primary revenue source, but we did better than anticipated." Not long after that, Crosby saw the opening for the town manager job in Apex. The first thing she noticed was the shift in government structure away from sometimes volatile, strong mayor system. "First, I was interested in getting a town council manager form of government," she says, "and so that was really the first thing." Crosby had a few other jobs she was pursuing, but the more she looked at the Apex job, the more she said it seemed to fit with her and her abilities. And we'll have to skip to the end of the article, as most of it talks about growth and affordable housing being the major issues. And she says the economic development opportunities have to be addressed. And she says those issues have to be figured out to continue to attract people to the area. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.